This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by ProPax with NT-Factor, a complete vitamin and mineral formula. NT-Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to reduce fatigue, whatever the cause, whether it be age, illness, or just being run down. NT-Factor repairs damaged cells, restores healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Clinical trials have shown NT-Factor reduces fatigue by almost half, and it even reverses some symptoms of aging. I've been taking NT-Factor for years, and now the 45-day money-back guarantee, you have nothing to lose. To order, call 800-982-9158, that's 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com, that's ntfactor.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're talking to the author of a great new book just out, The Lyme Solution, a five-part plan to fight the inflammatory autoimmune response and beat Lyme disease. Our guest, the author, Darren Ingles. Darren is a naturopathic physician. He's one of my good colleagues here in the Northeast, which is ground zero for Lyme disease. But don't kid yourself, because Lyme disease is not confined to the environs of Lyme, Connecticut, where it was discovered. We now recognize that Lyme disease occurs in all 50 states across the United States, and in many parts of Europe, it's a big problem. And so, Darren, it's a five-part plan. So, you know, the book goes into it in great detail, but could you outline what that involves? It certainly doesn't involve just more and more and more antibiotics, does it?
No, it doesn't. You know, I'm trying to take a very complex illness and put it into relatively simple terms. So I don't want to sort of oversimplify this.
Right. It's not a DIY thing necessarily, but at least you can provide some directions for people suffering from these problems.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, the five-part plan really starts with treating the gut. You know, as we talked about in part one, you know, the gut really is the cornerstone of the immune system. And we could probably argue the cornerstone of health. And certainly a lot of chronic illness often stems from any kind of disruption in the gut and certainly the microbiome. So, you know, I'm always very interested in people with Lyme disease on how well they're digesting their food, how well they're absorbing their food, what kind of foods that they're eating, what their stress levels like, you know, all these different factors that influence how the gut functions, certainly is going to have an impact on, you know, your gut flora and how well you move things through your system. So I think, you know, people need to be reminded, if they're not already familiar with, you know, you should be going to the bathroom at least once a day, if not more. I mean, if you look at the animal kingdom, you know, 20 minutes after an animal eats, it poops. So ideally, you know, if you eat three times a day, we'd love for you to poop three times a day. That doesn't happen for most of the people I work with, but I would say if we can have you eliminating once or twice a day and they're well-formed, not too hard, not loose or diarrhea, you don't see undigested food or blood in your stool. You know, looking at the kind of the quality of your stooling is actually tells you a lot about your gut health. So making sure that that's in place, and certainly for anyone who's been on antibiotics, particularly long-term, this is always of great concern, because it's very possible that all that stuff we expect to happen isn't happening. Because as your microbiome gets disrupted, it can change the way things move through your system. It can make sometimes your stool a little looser, watery. You know, diarrhea is a very common side effect of long-term antibiotics. So, you know, I'm always talking with people about how that process is going for them. And the nice thing is, you know, we have a lot of things in the natural world between herbs and nutrients that can really facilitate healing the gut if there has been any kind of element of gut damage.
And, you know, another thing that we've recognized recently about antibiotics is they actually are mitochondrial disruptors, because, you know, the old theory, and I'm sure you're well aware of it, is that billions of years ago, bacteria combined with proto-animal cells, animal cells that were very primitive, and the bacteria kind of signed a deal with those cells: I'll go inside you and I'll become an energy factory. And so the mitochondria actually, in evolutionary terms, might be akin to bacteria. So when we use powerful antibacterials, we may actually damage the mitochondria, damage the body's energetics. And people who have Lyme disease, they get sometimes many, many series of antibiotics, even intravenous antibiotics.
Right. And, you know, with the mitochondria, it becomes a bit of a double whammy because Lyme disease itself has been shown to damage the mitochondria. You know, combine that with the long-term antibiotics, you know, it's no surprise that we see, you know, again, chronic fatigue, muscle weakness, a lot of cognitive impairment, because, you know, you need your mitochondria for all those processes to work well. So it certainly adds up. And I think that's a huge contributing factor to, you know, sort of throwing gas on the fire, so to speak.
What do you like for mitochondrial support? That's part of your five-part plan of restoring optimal function.
Yeah, well, you know, we kind of call it a mito cocktail, and I think a lot of, you know, integrative doctors have their variants of it. But sort of the two nutrients I think that are the cornerstone of that is coenzyme CoTN or CoQ10 and carnitine. Both of these are involved in mitochondrial function, and we know that part of the way you can help rebuild your mitochondria if they've been damaged is through these nutrients. And perhaps one of the biggest cofactors of that is vitamin B6. So I like that combination of B6, carnitine, and particularly I like acetyl L-carnitine just because some of the research on cognitive impairment. And then CoQ10. And I find, you know, with Lyme patients, often you have to use fairly high doses to really see clinical improvement.
I think what's most interesting about your approach to this is as a naturopathic physician and as someone who's trained in high-tech microbiology and come from a technical background, you're sort of eclectic. You sort of pick and choose components of your protocol from different segments of the armamentarium. And among the things you choose are some herbs that, you know, some people may not be familiar with. I think a lot of people know about curcumin and garlic and, you know, sort of the standard Western repertoire of herbs. But there's some that are a little bit esoteric that you talk about.
Yeah, you know, there's some great herbs that we use them a lot for their anti-inflammatory capacity. So there's a great herb that comes out of India called Boswellia. And Boswellia,
again, that is familiar. That's actually, you know, a lot of listeners know about that one.
Yeah, Boswellia. There's another one called Harpagophytum. Harpagophytum is
Devil's
also
Claw.
Devil's Claw is a great anti-inflammatory. There's some good evidence that sea cucumber is also a good anti-inflammatory. You know, we have so many of Salix, which also goes by white willow bark. This is where they actually discovered aspirin from. It has a component in it that they discovered. So white willow bark for a lot of people works well. You know, I think, you know, finding these different combinations of anti-inflammatory herbs. And of course, you know, you mentioned curcumin probably being the one that has perhaps the most research behind it. That combination can really be effective at, you know, helping control inflammation.
But you know, back to basics, you also have an opinion about what people should do if they've been bitten by a tick. And there you kind of revert. That's one instance where you wouldn't say, oh, antibiotics contraindicated. You would actually say, go for it.
Yeah, I think for someone who has a known tick bite, you know, if you happen to find a tick on yourself and you pull it off, I do recommend that you save the tick and send it off to a lab to be tested. You know, it's not 100% perfect, but if your tick comes back and it's positive for Lyme or a co-infection, it just gives you more impetus to be treated. But the rule, I think, particularly living in the Northeast or a Lyme endemic area, is that if you pull off a tick, particularly if you know it's a deer tick, because there's going to be a lag time before you get test results back on the tick, I think it's very prudent to be proactive in treatment just because the longer you wait, potentially the harder it is to treat. So, you know, the CDC used to have a recommendation. I think they've now taken that down, which was a single dose of doxycycline, which really had no evidence that that was effective at all.
So it's just take like two pills and that's it.
Two pills and that's it once, you know, and then, you know, hopefully that's enough. But again, that was really kind of completely unsubstantiated, and I don't even see it on their website anymore. So I don't think that they even have that recommendation. But my feeling is, again, you know, if you know you've been bit by a deer tick, while you're waiting is to be proactive and start antibiotic therapy. You know, hopefully catch it before it ever gets to a point where it can spread and cause more damage to the body. You know, we could argue that the antibiotics themselves cause their own set of issues, but I think this is a case where using the antibiotics short term is probably going to have a protective effect and just save people potentially, you know, months to years of grief from dealing with, you know, chronic Lyme disease. So I'd much rather people get treated early. Again, I think this is a very appropriate case where antibiotics can be effective and, again, keep people from, you know, getting further problems.
So another reason why people don't get well is because they may be suffering from co-infections that aren't properly diagnosed. What are some of those and how are they treated?
Well, every time I go to a Lyme conference, it seems like the list of things that these ticks longer. Can transmit outside of, yeah, gets longer and longer. But, you know, some of the more common ones, particularly up in the Northeast, there's a bacteria called Bartonella that we typically associate with cat scratch fever. Cats are carriers of this bacteria, but you can get it through a tick bite. There's a blood parasite called Babesia, and Babesia is a cousin of malaria, so it can cause a lot of malaria-ish kind of symptoms.
Cyclic symptoms that come and go.
Fevers and sweating and things of that nature. We also have another bacteria called Anaplasma. There's another bacteria called Ehrlichia. You can get actually Rickettsia, which causes Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And actually, there's now a slew of viruses that are starting to emerge as well. And I think perhaps at the end of last year, we started hearing about one called Powassan virus, which I think is very frightening, that it's a very dangerous virus. And of course, you know, antibiotics don't do anything to kill viruses. But this virus was responsible for a handful of deaths through New York and Massachusetts, and I think maybe one in Connecticut. So without being able to recognize it, you know, that itself is a problem. But the viruses, I think, you know, we probably need to start looking a little bit more at. I think we've always focused on the bacterial co-infections, and I think we should be paying equally attention to some of the viral co-infections, just because, again, they are treated completely differently, and certainly something like Powassan is potentially much more dangerous.
Now, so a little bit of a conundrum here, because on the one hand, you want to support the immune system to fight off infection, but on the other hand, this may have an autoimmune component. So how do you square off the ends of that and come up with an appropriate balancing of the immune system?
Well, I think whether someone's dealing with acute or chronic Lyme disease, we're always doing things to try and help support their overall immune function. You know, this kind of comes back to supporting the terrain. So that kind of comes back to, you know, dealing with gut health. You know, again, when the gut's working well, the immune system will naturally work well. But again, we have a lot of other nutrients and herbs that we do to help support the immune system. For example, you know, I like an herb called astragalus. I think astragalus is a very good immune supportive herb. We also use another one called andrographis. Andrographis actually has some very good research, and andrographis is also a very good antiviral. So certainly for anyone who might have a viral co-infection, that could be very appropriate. And of course, we use a lot of nutrients, things like, you know, vitamin C. And I think every Lyme patient I've seen, and probably every patient you've seen, is vitamin D deficient. And we know now that vitamin D is a very important immune regulator. So, you know, we've got a lot of natural things that we can do to help support the immune system at a sort of a fundamental level. And then beyond that, we start getting into more targeted therapies, again, depending on really whether it's sort of acute or persistent Lyme disease.
And there's a lot of emphasis in your book on lifestyle, which is kind of an overlooked component of conventional treatment for Lyme disease. Just looking at the basics, you know, sleep, exercise, you know, that type of input into the disease process. How important is that?
Well, I think, you know, it's critical. And as you mentioned, I think it's also probably perhaps the most overlooked part of any treatment for any chronic condition. And I see a lot of Lyme patients that after they get exposed, they start to experience a lot of sleep disturbances. And, you know, when you again start going through how people are sleeping and looking at their quality of sleep, it's really not uncommon that they aren't sleeping deeply, they're not sleeping well. You know, chemically, that's important because when you get into that deep restorative sleep, that's when your neurons repair itself, that's when your tissue does a lot of its repair. So if you're not getting that deep restorative sleep, you know, you're really missing out on your body's ability to naturally heal on its own. So I think it's one of those things that I certainly hone in early in an office visit with someone with Lyme, is to make sure they're getting that good deep sleep. You know, we want to use the body as much as possible to naturally heal. And really, this is one of the things that you can really make a big difference in just improving people's quality of sleep.
And how often do you see concomitant mold sensitivity in your patients with Lyme? Because some people are pretty tolerant of mold. Other people, you know, are 4-plus sick. Does this have to do with immune dysregulation?
Yeah, and you know, interestingly, when you look at the symptoms of mold exposure, mold toxicity, and Lyme disease, the symptoms are almost identical. I think it's the one thing that probably mimics Lyme disease more than anything else. And certainly up in the Northeast, you know, mold is a huge problem. And so, you know, you can have mold allergy, which is an immune reaction to mold spores, but you can also have what's called mycotoxicity. And that means certain molds secrete a toxin that when you breathe it in, it can damage your nervous system, damage your lungs. So often we have to go through the process of trying to determine if that's part of the picture. Again, if someone who lives in a 100-year-old house and perhaps there's been a leaky roof or a flooded basement, you know, any kind of water damage can certainly set the stage of having mycotoxicity. But mold allergy is really can be anywhere where there's mold. And, you know, short of the desert regions of the country, just about everywhere else has some element of mold exposure. You know, some places are worse than others, but I think that's something that you got to keep in the back of your mind if you've been dealing with chronic Lyme. You know, are you also dealing with a concomitant mold issue?
And is that partially the result of the antibiotics, which may cause candida or a yeast overgrowth in the gastrointestinal tract that hypersensitizes the immune system to related species? I mean, the mold isn't candida, but it's still of a fungal origin.
Exactly. You know, they're still under the umbrella of a fungi, and there's a lot of cross-reactivity between mold and yeast. And again, you know, it's a well-known side effect of, you know, antibiotics that, you know, you can develop a secondary yeast problem. And, you know, candida probably gets all the press, but the reality is that we've got a lot of different species of yeast, both in the gut, in the nose, in the throat, on the skin, that can all get altered with long-term antibiotic use. But I do see people that it seems that they do become hypersensitized to mold spores. And again, if you happen to live in an area where there's a lot of mold, that tends to be problematic. But, you know, mold itself can cause fatigue and brain fog and respiratory problems and joint pain and a lot of things that Lyme patients experience. So if you've already had those symptoms because of Lyme and then you get exposed to mold and your symptoms get worse, you know, clinically, it could be very difficult to distinguish which one's which. So it's a good idea to go through with your practitioner to try and figure out if, you know, mold's adding to your body burden.
So the Lyme Solution, a five-part plan, it's just out. And Darren Ingalls, the author. Darren, you know, I know you're busy getting interviewed and campaigning for your book because it's just out, but also you have a private practice here in the Northeast. Is that correct?
I have two private practices. I have one in Fairfield, Connecticut, and I have one in Irvine, California.
Oh, wow. You're really, literally bi-coastal. That's why I see you on Facebook in so many different places. You're from Southern California originally, aren't you?
You know, I lived all over the country, but I'll say I spent my formative years in Southern California. So, yeah, Southern California is probably more home to me than the East Coast.
Well, you know, I'm from Santa Monica. I grew up in Santa Monica. So,
yeah,
my old stomping grounds. Your practice, how do people get the heads up on that? Do you have a website as well?
Yeah, so the best way is if you go to DarrenIngallsND.com. It has all the information about the book, about my private practice, and you know we just post a lot of information, educational material about Lyme disease and other things. So you know we'd love for people to sign up for our newsletter and follow us on social media. And hopefully we'll just give a lot of useful information to help people get well.
Well, the book is a great start. And there's a lot of specifics in the book that we haven't been able to touch on. You know, how to source, you know, unusual herbal combinations. You know, there's a lot of protocols that I think will come in handy for sufferers of Lyme disease. The spelling, Darren, D-A-R-I-N, Ingalls, I-N-G-E-L-S. And the website, Darren Ingles, ND, as in Nancy, David. That's the website for more information. Darren, congratulations. And hey, you know, this, I think, is really one of the best books yet on Lyme disease, and incorporates a really kind of integrative approach to this problem, which is so challenging for so many people.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, Ron. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. All the best. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.